Turn around. Do you see the overpass above the pedestrian zone? Go towards it, then pass under it. Now we are getting to the core. Our eyes must now become adjusted to a different light. We want to learn how to look when we want to see what doesn't want to be seen. We want to look at how the city is built, what materials it is made of. Walk past the entrances to City Point and Drehscheibe. Read how it is labeled, what it says clearly and what is less clear, what can be interpreted. When you get to the main street, stop there between the facades of City Point and Drehscheibe. Do you see this bridge in the air over the pedestrian precinct between Drehscheibe and City Point? Good. Now imagine that this overpass is a box in the theatre, with a good view, with perspective. From there you look down, from there you see. The stage is ready with light, sound and space, and the performers are in play. Notice them. Since the 19th century, an analogy or metaphor has constantly and repeatedly come to mind when urban researchers think about urban space, namely that the city secretly forms the theatre or stage of society, that in the heart of modern metropolises, everyday social life is performed in condensed form. Here, then, society can be observed particularly well by watching its performances, following its comedies and studying its scenes. So, if we look at the city as a stage, as a film set, or as the site of a performance, then its artifacts, or the lanterns, benches, litter bins, are, as it were, or props. By their design, the variation of the pieces we can perform in urban space is already strongly predetermined. In this light, the question arises as to who actually decides on these props, whether one might need other props, or even have to produce them oneself, if one wants the program or the cast to change. What kind of play is actually being performed here? Who has the leading and supporting roles? Who are the extras? And who exactly decides on the program? The search for answers to these questions can lead to interesting insights, as can the questions of who decides on the decor, whether the stage builders are unionized, how much the entrance fee is, and so on. So it is definitely worth looking at the city through these dramaturgical glasses. However, this analogy also has blind spots. It fails to recognize that in everyday urban life, social order is not merely performed and acted out, but above all, produced. Cities are not only gigantic apparatuses of representation, but above all, serve as places for the production of society. The city is not just our stage. It is, as the French Marxist Henri Lefebvre said, first and foremost, our factory. Here we do not play, but work. Urban space is a machine room, not a backdrop. Cities are therefore not only stages, but at least also places of manufacturing of the social. They are gigantic factory halls for the production of power relations, of economy, social relations, and not least of what is called everyday life, even before anything could be performed. Turn around so that the overpass is behind you. Turn left. Do you see the underground entrance, Rathaus Süd? Walk past it. turn right directly behind the underground entrance and cross the street carefully. Go up the opposite street. Do you see the little church on the left? Walk past the church. Do you see the spherical statue? Stop at the sphere and look around from there. Look again at your whole environment. While looking, you could count the street lights, for example. Do they make the street bright? Or do they illuminate you? Look around you. An important question you could ask in the city is whether the environment is inviting, and who it invites to what, or who is disinvited from that environment. This question, that is the question of how to keep unwelcome users and bodies out of public space, has been addressed for several decades by an entire field of practice, the field of so-called defensive architecture. Under this practice, a whole repertoire of design strategies is implemented, with which, for example, homeless people are prevented from using certain places as places to sleep. This is done, for example, by adding the notorious spikes or concrete knobs on the floor, in front of shops or in overly cozy alcoves. Small floor designs that are meant to keep out unwelcome animals as well as people. And since the 19th century, public lighting has also been an important instrument for the regulation of public space. For it has always served primarily to help the police keep a better eye on the urban population, rather than to help inhabitants find their way around better or more safely in the dark. In addition to light designs for the screening of squares, there is also the active expulsion from squares, for example, by blasting public spaces with classical music or high-frequency disturbing noises, which for many make a longer stay in such places maddening and thus impossible. All of these forms of defensive architecture have one thing in common, namely that the design objects take on police functions. A lantern as a street warden, a weatherproof sound system as an enforcer of curfew hours, or spiky floor tiles as night watch in front of shops. Instead of human law enforcement officers who address their fellow citizens, issue expulsions or supervise the public space, architecture and design regulate the inner cities at all times, and almost imperceptibly, subtly, silently. Individual parts of a public order carrying out a designed program, space, form, and things, police agents of an idea of the city. And what are these attempts at defense actually directed against? Against public nuisances, graffiti and street art, skating, idleness, public sleeping or socializing. Of all things, combating these practices quickly became one of the most important fields of action for architecture and urban planning. The result? The inner cities of today often sterile and latently hostile, uniform up to exclusive, in the literal sense of the word, exclusionary. From the form of the city, we can deduce for whom it is intended and for whom it is not. From the things, we read their idea. Now, take a quick look at the people around you. Do you think they are aware of what the city is doing to them? Or are they busy with something else, for example, with a role that was written for them? Now, go on to the square. Do you see the little playground and the painting of the owl on the wall on the left? Go there. We are now opening our gaze. Look at the playground. What a picture. Take it in for a moment. Metal, steel, sand and fake wood. Peculiar shapes and half a roof. Height and spacing tailored to an average-shaped child. Look at the color choices, the assumed average taste of children between 4 and 12. What you see here is a materialized assumption of fitting bodies and an idea turned into a climbing frame. A plan for scenarios of usage in this place. You recognize the idea from the frame. Who should come? What should they look like? Who is allowed to play? How long may it be fun? Why here? A playground in an adult environment. This is the city at the end of its ideas. Now, sit on the wall, calmly. There is hardly an environment that is so thoroughly designed and planned as urban public space. From paths, surfaces and signs to bollards, barriers and the city's furniture, such as benches, litter bins and lighting. You only have to look around and take a closer look. For example, to the right, next to you, at the Starbucks. The spikes on the signs, under the roof. Or the number and arrangement of the lanterns. The design of the benches. The distribution and shape of the litter bins. The design of all these public objects is anything but neutral, random, or even apolitical. Instead, they and the space created and designed by them are highly imbued with ideology and power. For the way the city is built and designed has a central influence on the possible perceptions, interactions, and everyday life of its inhabitants and users. The design of the city enables or impedes certain forms of encounter and exchange, mobility, accessibility, activities, and rest. How and by whom a shopping street, a square, or an urban park should and can be used tells us a lot about the demands, plans and paradigms of modern societies. And it says a lot about which groups of people are welcome, tolerated or unwanted here. Very subtly, the spatial design and object forms draw boundaries of what is possible in the city, and hardly noticeably so, precisely because the design is part of everyday life, or the daily gaze of the familiar environment. There are, of course, also quite obvious regulations and rules of conduct in all urban spaces. They are communicated, for example, by signs and notices. No noise, no smoking, no drinking, no ball games, no unannounced gatherings, no handing out leaflets, etc. At the same time, however, a whole series of hidden, implicit rules and norms are at work in the design of the urban environment, which are not easily recognized as such, yet highly effective. With regulative designs, planners and architects anticipate possible ways of using urban space, as well as its ideal users, and plan towards this ideal. They try to intuitively suggest certain practices and behaviors and make others impossible, thus very discreetly controlling inclusion and exclusion. For example, a bench in a shopping street, if there is one at all, allows sitting, not too comfortably, for a short period of time. However, it makes it impossible to lie down, for example, because the bench is often too short for this, or deliberately equipped with additional armrests in the middle. Because they are bolted to the ground, it is also not possible to put several benches together and thus form a larger suite from the isolated seats. The most radical step in this series of design decisions, then, is a stripped-down city centre virtually without seating. A place of constant move, of hurrying through, of getting things done. No place to stay. No place to reside. Just like here, a place almost without rest. Count the benches here. The benches, not the bangs. This is a public square. How many benches? Have you noticed that two of them are also rather hidden? And now think about the 370,000 inhabitants of Bochum. So, if you want to sit, you have to buy something in a cafe or restaurant. Thus, by the design alone, a big decision is made about what kind of city one is shaping. Here specifically, whether there is street furniture, how many pieces, who can use the street furniture, for how long, where exactly and in what posture and social situation. These questions determine the use of a square, a street, a pedestrian precinct, and thus, in fact, who can come at all. Of course, the city users are first and foremost seen as bodies, so the design is primarily concerned with what all these bodies are allowed to do in the space, which gestures, positions and movements they are allowed to perform where, and how many of them there should be. Leave the playground, turn left and go further up the road. Cross the narrow road carefully. Go past the parking garage from the right side. Walk along the road until you reach the traffic lights. This check ends there. cross the road straight ahead, and when you're on the other side, play the next track.